While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to On the Reader News Analysis right here on Eagle FM. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and today is Wednesday, the 22nd of April, 2026. Now, midweek is where the real picture begins to emerge. The energy of the week starts, has settled, and what remains is execution, measured, tested, and increasingly visible. Now, across the country, from Swakopmund to Rundu, or Chuarongo to Rudret, Katima Mulilo to Khobabas, the question is no longer what is planned, but what is working. So today, we turn our focus to delivery under pressure. Our policies moving beyond intention into impact, our investments translating into opportunity, and are the systems meant to support growth keeping pace with the demands on the ground? We take a closer look at Namibia's economic trajectory, with particular attention on green industrialization, investment readiness, and how the country is positioning itself in an increasingly competitive global environment. Momentum is building, but so is the urgency to convert ambition into measurable results. Young Namibians remain central to this shift. From enterprise to innovation, their influence is not on the horizon. It is already shaping outcomes. The critical question now is whether institutions are evolving fast enough to match the drive. We'll also examine governance in action, where policy meets performance as implementation takes center stage. Accountability, efficiency, and results are no longer optional. They are expected. Where progress is evident, we'll unpack it. Where challenges persist, we'll interrogate them. And through it all, we stay grounded in the lived experience, where national strategy meets everyday reality, because the true measure of progress is not in policy documents, but in lives they are meant to improve. Over the next hour and 30 minutes, expert sharp insight, meaningful analysis, and conversations that do go beyond the surface. This right here is On the Reading News Analysis on Eagle FM, where we don't just follow the story, we unpack its impact. Now let's get right into today's analysis. Namibia is moving to strengthen its position in the global shift between low carbon development through formulation of Strategic Transformation Investment Plan, also known as STIP, a key step toward accessing major climate financing. Of course, yesterday we reported on news of CIFIDP STIP at stakeholder engagement, which is being held at Protea Hotel in Walvis Bay, whereby the mayor of Walvis Bay, Johannes Shimbilinga, underscored the importance of coordinated investment planning in driving sustainable economic growth, calling on collaboration from stakeholders, that is from government, industry, civil society, and stressing the collaboration that it is essential for Namibia to fully leverage opportunities in green industrialization. Now, Namibia's STIP is being developed under the Climate Investment Funds, CIF, Industry Decarbonization Program, IDP, and is designed to identify priority investment-ready projects that can accelerate low-carbon industrial development. Now, the plan is also a prerequisite for accessing concessional funding under CIF programs. Of course, for Namibia, this could unlock up to $250 million in financing. Now, at the heart of the initiative is the push for green industrialization, seen as a critical pathway for Namibia to diversify its economy and reduce carbon emissions and create sustainable jobs. Of course, Namibia's efforts form part of a broader international push under the CIF Industry Decarbonization Program. The program opened for expressions of interest on the 3rd of October 2024 during the 15th Clean Energy Ministerial that was held in Brazil. Now, the initiative aims to invest in pioneering low carbon pathways for heavy emitted industries in developing countries, particularly within clean technology supply chains, and it is intended to support innovation, scale emerging technologies, and support a just transition to net zero economies. Eligible countries working with multilateral development bank partners were invited to submit expressions of interest, that is by January 2025, with the option of including private sector partners to strengthen project implementations. The for Namibia's STIP will be submitted to the Climate Investment Funds for review, after which selected projects could move into detailed design and financing stage. Of course, we got hold of Verushka Dumeni, who is a science researcher and also a lecturer. But let's take a listen to what she had to say during that conversation. A very good afternoon to you, Verushka Dumeni, and it's a pleasure to have you with me right here on the Reading News Analysis.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, Verushka, we're talking about Namibia's STIP being developed under the Climate Investment Funds for Industry Decarbonization Program. First, beforehand, I think I want us to lay some understanding for most of us in understanding industry decarbonization programs. What is that all about, and why is it very significant to our environment and for climate as well?
Oh, awesome question. So most of our industrial activities, be it mining or extraction of anything or even just processing any product manufacturing plant, really requires on a source of energy, right? Energy drives all the processes and actions of that particular industry. Now, the question is, where does that energy come from, right?
Yeah.
And majority of our energy, yes, it's in the form of electricity, but the real source of that energy is most likely coal, so burning of coal, and or any other fossil fuels, right? And when we talk about industry decarbonization, is essentially moving away from those fossil fuel sources of energy so that the emissions from the energy sourcing does not end up polluting our environment and therefore worsening the climate change that we're experiencing right now. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially trying to say, what are the industries that can actually source and tap into renewable energy, or what are the industries that can reduce their emissions overall by perhaps adapting or implementing some other nature regenerative processes or activities.
Yeah.
So it's just about reducing your carbon footprint, reducing your emissions as an industry. If you cannot do that completely, then you have to subsidize it by essentially financing or collaborating in some sort of nature protection or nature restoration, which itself can then do that for you.
Now, I guess now this is where finances or investment plays a very critical or important role. Now, I think for as long as I can remember in high school, you know, there's something that we taught about to say, hey, let's talk about fossil fuels and how we can actually play our part. But I think there's clearly a rigging behind in investors coming on board. Could it be because maybe they are not thoroughly made aware of what of the importance of low carbon emissions and all that? Could that be perhaps one of the reasons?
Oh, it's definitely many, many reasons. To be honest, if you are an investor, it would seem easier to tap into industry which are already existing, right? Instead of investing in a new form of energy which has its drawbacks. And so generally, there is a reluctance from investors to fully invest into something that is connected to renewable energies rather than just tapping into industries which already exist. And in addition to that, we see that this investment is much easier and more seamless in, you know, European countries and as well as the West, because they really have, you know, increased their renewable energies proportions of their industry. And so it then is easier because you can trust that these energy sources that are powering these industries and these processes actually work, right? You have the comfort that where you're putting your money is not in something that is seeming like an experiment. At the same time, it's exactly this kind of investment that can drive further investment into cleaner energy. Mm-hmm. So it's this catch-22 situation where without investment into industry decarbonization and also renewable industries, we will remain where we are depending on fossil fuels, which is in turn harming us, harming the ecosystems, and depleting the very resources that our industries depend on.
Mm-hmm. And then again, let me also ask this question to say that there are quite also a number of people who feel like there's nothing that we can really do in terms of climate change. You know, nature is going to have its way regardless of would you reduce this or reduce or not reduce that. How true or how not true is that statement?
It's not only true, but it's very dangerous, right? Giving up is essentially preparing yourself for the worst case scenarios, which many people actually don't really comprehend what that looks like. We are currently suffering from fuel prices that went up some weeks ago. And we saw that every aspect of society was affected by that, whether it's your grocery bill, whether it's your municipality bill, everything. If you're a logistics company, you know that you had to increase your prices for your clients. Everything was affected by fuel price. And when we're talking about climate change and the effects of that, it's much, much worse than that, because every element of nature is impacted by climate change. Our water. The moment we run out of water, it's either that we'll have to desalinate or import water from somewhere, right? If we have any climate disaster, be it the drought that we experience, we know that we most likely have to take out a loan from either China or any other European country that is willing to you know, offer us help. That leads to debt. And health is another one that we really don't think about. Climate change directly impacts health, especially the health of the elderly and the very vulnerable, which means our own health sector will be under pressure. So the question is, when we say there's nothing we can do, actually giving up leads to something much worse. There is something we can do. We just have to find, for our country, our context, what is that most impactful list or group of actions that we can take, which immediately helps us improve our climate resilience, whether it's in the economy or at the household and smallholder farmer level.
Okay. Now, obviously, you are a science lecturer and a biologist. Which field of study would you perhaps encourage learners and students out there who want to go into really to venture into green industrialization, who see this picture and say, hey, you know what, I want to play my part? Which fields at this particular point in time are they perhaps able to take on so that they can understand better? And perhaps it will also unlock their minds in how they can bring up solutions and contributions that were perhaps not tapped into before?
Absolutely. This is a beautiful question. And it's so nuanced, because we then have to balance, you know, advising students based on what our economy can offer them. In other words, do these jobs actually exist, or are we just telling students to go in these fields?
Yeah.
At the same time, you also need to create a demand for these kinds of jobs. So it's not just sitting with, oh, these jobs don't exist. It's creating a demand for them so that we can actually create the industry, create the jobs. So to go back to your question, the industries that I would really encourage students look into is not just renewable energy, but solar energy, right?
My favorite.
Solar exists and we know it works. The science that is needed is improving the efficiency of our solar panels and improving the efficiency of our batteries. That needs a lot of innovation. And then it also goes into just product innovation. In other words, how do we improve our energy, the energy use efficiency of our appliances? We have a source of energy. How do we make sure that our appliances, our technologies don't waste that energy, but actually utilize it? So that innovation is also needed. And then we have other sources, things like geothermal, right? In the university that I lecture in, there's quite a few talks about geothermal and the potential of that. And so I would really invite students who are very innovative to go into that field. Hydropower is a wonderful one. We already have established one, so I wouldn't really recommend that more students flock there. But it's one of the really good renewable energies. And then I would, on the opposite of, maybe not opposite, but I would encourage students to go into environmental sciences, but not just the broad one, but restoring our degraded landscapes and ecosystems.
Nice.
And this is a big umbrella. You can go into restoring our bush encroachment farms by teaching farmers how to take up regenerative grazing. Right? And this is the kind of grazing where your cows don't just eat what is there, but your cows play a role in the ecosystem to bring the health back. So they help manure, they help trample, they help regenerate the soil health, regenerate our perennial grasses. So those kinds of, I think regenerative agriculture in general is a new booming industry that more young people need to go to so that we don't just leave the degraded farms with our elders, you know? Who are used to a different way of farming, but we go in there, innovative as we are, and we change how we treat the land so that it can regenerate, right? Not just continue depleting. The other one is ecosystem restoration. This is to say the ecosystems that are damaged, be it a wetland that is no longer functioning, it's no longer biodiverse, maybe it was polluted. How do we clean up the Goreangab Dam, right? So these are scientific solutions that we need so that at the same time, we are decarbonizing our industry. At the same time, we are restoring the ecosystems that were damaged so that they themselves can help regulate the climate again. They can help remove carbon dioxide. You know, they can help bring the species back, and that will have so many benefits. So overall, as a scientist, I would say renewable energy is a really promising one, not just any renewable energy, but the renewable energy that best fits our climate, our country, and our context, right? And then, of course, restoring our ecosystems, restoring our way of farming so that we can regenerate our land and make it more productive than what it currently is.
You spoke about geothermal. I kind of understood all the other ones, but geothermal, what exactly is that one and how does it actually work?
Geothermal essentially relies on heat. So there are several springs around Namibia. I heard there were 20 or 21 or so. And if we can tap into that heat, we can actually use that heat to generate electricity. It's slightly a longer process, but at the end of the day, if you have energy in the form of heat, you can easily translate that to energy in the form of electricity. Some countries have already done that. I believe Kenya has done that because they have the Rift Valley, which is, of course, lots of geothermal activity there. In other words, more heat. But it's something that we as Namibia have not really tapped into, even though in academia, it's becoming more and more clear that we do have the potential, some spots, which we really could use as a source of energy.
And the sun being rightly positioned above us.
100%.
Interesting. Okay. So, Verushka, I guess give us your final and thorough sort of like encouragement, not necessarily encouragement, but sort of like to pull us as well and on what our part, on what part do we as lay people, for instance, in this industry, we may not have the right capacity, the right knowledge, but what is our role? What role can we play when we're talking about low carbonization, decarbonization, low carbon, and, you know, what is our role in that part? What is it that we can do, even right from our households? What is it that we can do to actually contribute to decarbonization?
Okay, there's quite a long list of them. And depending on, you know, your own circumstances and your socioeconomic reality, it can really, really vary. But one of them is, for instance, if there are any renewable energy alternatives to anything in your life, it could be that you are maybe hailing a Yango and you saw that there's an option for the electrical vehicles, go for it and start a conversation with the driver. Ask them, how is it driving this car? How far can it take you? Those kinds of questions allow us to educate ourselves on the reality of things instead of just taking other people's opinions of them, right? And then we have things like events like expos that are connected to so many different fields, regenerative agriculture. We had an expo the other day, and renewable cars, so electric vehicle, vehicles expos. If we attend those, we also educate ourselves and we can sort of empower ourselves with the knowledge of, okay, what do I have access to in terms of alternatives and what would I like to inform myself more about? Other things is also just at the household level, just saving energy. It's the best and simplest thing that we can do. And we've all heard the steps of saving energy. We've all heard the steps of saving water. That really also helps. And then if there is any public discussions on decarbonization, please do attend. Ask the questions that you have. But also just be open-minded because this is a new way of doing business. And yes, it's not perfect, right? It's not going to, it's not going to operate the same level as what we are trying to replace. But if we are open to it and playing with it, then we can help improve it altogether. So it will just be about educate yourself by engaging with all these conversations. Do your best to reduce energy loss and water loss in your own household and family.
Yeah.
Maybe teach yourself some skills of, okay, they're talking about regenerative agriculture. What can I do in my garden that reduces the amount of water that I use, right? If my house is being built, how do I position my house and ask the designer to position my house such that it captures more heat and or more energy, and I don't then have to spend, you know, money on either heaters or AC or fireplaces, right. Things like that.
Right.
So there's a lot that we can do to improve our energy efficiency in our lives, but also educate ourselves on what is out there and what is possible, and then start imagining on what that could mean for us as Namibians.
Marushka, you mentioned a point that's very critical and very important there about building your house in a way that it positions itself, in a way that heat comes in better. You know, I've come to realize, and I think this is a building plan problem, right? For instance, where I live at my house, where actually the window has been placed, heat can't properly come in. And so when it's winter, it's more cold. I mean, yeah, it's more cold because then the heat is not really, the window is placed in a very different, and I noticed this is a mistake a lot of people make. And I think, it will really benefit us because look at the money that we spend, during winter time when you have to, buy more electricity so that you can use the heaters and all that kind of stuff in different rooms. But that's something that's, I think, not really spoken about a lot. But a very important aspect, yeah.
Absolutely. And I wish that this was a mandatory for any, you know, engineer or architect that is licensed to be house or building plans, you know. If you really just study the movement of the sun, which is very predictable all year round, you know how it's going to change. It may be lower, it may be higher. With that knowledge, you can actually design your house such that in the wintertime, you maximize the sunlight. In the summertime, you maximize the shade because the sun is slightly higher.
Yeah.
So those are things that, again, we can easily learn ourselves so that maybe when the building or the architect comes, then we can, you know, advocate for this, encourage that this is what we want. But at the same time, it's just something that I think needs to be institutionalized. Like, you know, we live in a very sunny country. It's going to be hotter by the day. So we might.
Phew, what a day. Finally on my way home. And hey, the taxi's empty. So much room. Oh no. Why is this big guy getting in and sitting on top of me? No, not the mimo with the big bag too. Now I'm squeezed.
Sometimes in life, you just get squeezed. But luckily, with Express Credit's term loans, you can get up to 32,000 Namibian dollars to help ease your financial squeeze in under 15 minutes.
Ah, now that's a relief.
Visit expresscredit.com.na. Express Credit, money when you need it.
A sunny country is going to be hotter by the day, so we might as well change the way we build or we design our buildings.
Yes.
And you mentioned something really important, which is just saving money. And what I wanted to talk about was that most of the times when we are trying to be sustainable, it actually ends up saving us money. So you ask yourself, your parents, what are the things they told you to do so that you can reduce waste and therefore reduce the expenses of the house? They would say, don't leave the water dripping. Don't leave the light on because the electricity bill goes up. Reuse this and that so that we don't have to buy a new thing.
Mm.
All these things. So oftentimes what saves us money is often more sustainable. Even just not buying unnecessary things is much more sustainable and it saves us money.
True. Very true.
Taking care of our devices, you know, not leaving them on the charger even though they are 100% full. These things all means that the battery life lasts longer and therefore we don't have to buy a new phone, which is dependent on mining. So all these things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so very. And with that, let's pause right here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back to continue with this conversation. Stay tuned.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and of course, we're still continuing with our conversation on decarbonization and the ASTIP that is currently underway. Now, joining us in studio telephonically right now is Jonah Musheko, the Communications Manager of Namibia Green Hydrogen Program. A very good afternoon to you, Jonah Musheko, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
Good afternoon to you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you indeed. Jonah, let's talk about the stakeholder engagement currently underway in Walvis Bay. And of course, conversations around here to talk about finances and actually getting investment for Namibia's green industrialization. But how exactly is the program going? And also kindly get into us how Namibia is playing its part towards this stakeholder engagement.
Well, thank you. What is happening is that maybe I can give a brief background just to highlight where we are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
As a country, obviously we have a lot of initiatives within the green hydrogen space, but where we are falling now for this specific stakeholder engagement is the what we call the CIF Industry Decarbonization Program, which Namibia participated last year. CIF is a climate investment fund, a global entity really into funding initiatives to promote decarbonization,
mm-hmm.
and obviously utilization of renewable resources. So last year we applied as a country to get funding. They have availed actually $1 billion for countries that will be successfully meeting their standards,
mm-hmm.
and requirements. And Namibia applied for that funding with other 26 or 27 countries globally.
Yeah.
And we came number three. We came number three with Mexico and Brazil on top of us. and Africa at number four. For the first time, I think we are kind of leading our big brother, who usually is the leader in most of the things we are doing.
Yeah.
So that means that we were given an opportunity to really access about $250 million of concessional financing.
Mm-hmm.
But this concessional financing should be poured into projects that are really into green industrialization, like you put it. So we have then had to run call for project proposals. So that is last year around September, where we invited Namibians with different projects that could be linked to green industrialization. That call for project proposal ran for about five months or 6 months, so we can count from September until February this year. After it is closed, we have done the assessment and evaluation together with a consultant that was hired by World Bank, because the CIF entity works together with multilateral development banks, and one of them is World Bank.
Mm-hmm.
So World Bank hired a consultant for us to help us in this process of submitting now the sectoral transformation investment plan, which will justify how much should we get, because the $250 million, it's the maximum we can access.
Mm.
But we can only get more of that, or all of it, depending to the projects we are going to submit now through this process.
Okay.
So we then shortlisted about 78 projects that made it from 148 applications.
Wow.
And those projects now, we are busy refining and getting more details from them. And part of the requirement and the part of the submission that we're going to make around August there, we are also required to make sure that we do a thorough stakeholder engagement, most especially in regions where we see that most of those projects are coming from or will be implemented. That's why we're finding ourselves in the area of Barbers Bay, that is the Rongo region.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we'll be moving on to Karas region, and then eventually back to Windhoek, and then we spread to other regions based on the number of projects that we have shortlisted are coming from those specific regions. So it's a requirement that we do stakeholder engagement, and this stakeholder engagement is really to make sure that, remember, most of these projects will be new projects, and they will be able to be established only if all the stakeholders, we are talking about the NamWater, NamPower, the Port Authority, the local authority in terms of land availability, the communities themselves, because remember, you can't just be putting a project in communities and they don't understand what is it.
Exactly.
They will give you tough time.
Of course.
So that's basically what we are doing to make sure that we have consulted everyone where we anticipate this project to be established. And that when eventually the money is rolled into Namibia by next year, early next year, there will be no hurdles of saying, no, we were not consulted. We don't understand why do you want more land? Why do you want land of this nature? We have earmarked that for our housing or some other projects. We want everyone to understand from the water perspective, electricity or non-power utility, and everyone to make sure that they understand what we are trying to do, so that when these projects eventually make it to be financed next year, everyone is on par, and if it's permits will be given without necessarily difficulties. And also, if there is need for offtake, everyone is prepared to buy whatever product we are going to produce as green product that is produced or processed with green hydrogen. But not only that, the projects we have received, not all of them are even looking at producing green hydrogen. Some of them are actually just technologies that really decarbonize any sector. You can talk about electrical vehicles. So we are trying to really increase our number of vehicles we have in the country that operate on either electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And we can only do that if, for instance, we have got number of charging stations in the country.
Interesting.
So there are some projects that only submitted to say, me, I will be setting up enough charging stations from Barbers Bay to Windhoek so that people are able to commute to drive between Windhoek and Barbers Bay, electrical vehicles, and they are able to make sure that they can really, really, really utilize those vehicles without difficulty. So basically, that's why we're doing the consultation.
That's quite interesting. Very, very interesting, especially where you speak about 150 companies having expressed interest in this CIF. Obviously, program in with you guys and having shortlisted, I think about 70 something, you said?
Yes, so we have shortlisted about 77 or 78.
Mm, that's a lot too. And also that's a quite another interesting aspect to know that they are so, because my next question was to ask you about in which areas are they perhaps expressing interest in, especially now? But then you mentioned about also some companies having that initiative to say, I will set up, of course, obviously when they do get the finances, I will set up electrical charging ports, which is something also that Namibia unfortunately doesn't have much of, as much as maybe some people may want to have electrical vehicles. They might be skeptical in terms of where do I actually go and charge my vehicle. But what are some of the areas too that the companies have expressed interest in? I'm certain that solar panels is one of those who want to perhaps sort of set up solar panels in different households, yeah, and maybe even urban areas are part of them. Yeah, but yeah. What are some of the...
Some of the themes that we picked up in terms of proposals is, for instance, adding value to minerals,
okay,
using hydrogen. So remember, we already have got projects that their focus is just to produce green hydrogen.
Yes, right.
Then we must then find another value chain component where we are using that hydrogen to process our our mineral resources to add value to them. And that is exactly what is happening at one of the flagship projects in Erongo here, which is Iron Oshivela. We are producing green hydrogen and use it to process iron ore. So we have a lot of those that are also looking at how do we use hydrogen to process iron ore. Then the other, or not iron ore, but just minerals. It could be lithium, it could be anything, even in terms of cement processing. There's a component in cement production that we can actually decarbonize because of high emission of carbon during the process of production of cement.
Okay.
So some of them are also into the in the space of saying, look, there are a lot of, Namibia is it's quite diverse in terms of space. And we have got so much distance between towns and between where some of our people are. And what we may need is independent power production units, which you have to do through either wind farms or solar energy facilities. So some of them are looking at how do we give solutions to households that are far away from our national grid system, so that we can connect them to electricity. That way it cuts on the cost of transportation of electricity from the main towns to deep inland where these people are. So you can then develop or design a project design really, really meant to solve that problem of power and make sure that you can sell that idea or link it as an offtake towards non-power. So there's a lot of this type of initiatives that are looking at really solving real problems. And some are also looking into, the aspects that NAMPOWER has been pushing for a number of years, the independent power production,
mm-hmm,
which you can then come in with your power, your power production coming from renewable energy. We need to make, some of them are actually really pushing that idea to say, well, if I get the money, I just need an offtake agreement with NAMPOWER, and then this and this and this, I'll be able to sell my power to NAMPOWER. And then we can eventually reduce the amount of power we buy from abroad to consume locally, because that's one of the reasons why our power really keeps going up, because outside there where we get the power from, we can't really do much in terms of price control. But if we are producing it locally, there might be a possibility that we can be able to say, okay, this is renewable energy we are producing locally. Perhaps we can look at the cost and see how we can share the cost and make sure that the consumer doesn't really bear a lot of high prices in terms of units.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, from the expression of interest from different entrepreneurs or different people within the Namibian sector, what have you deduced from it? Do you think we have now gotten to a point where a lot of Namibians understand the green industrialization and also how they can play their part into contributing to job employment and to our economy overall?
What we have gotten from that, like you said, is really an impression that we actually thought people were not following and people didn't really care of what we are doing much. And we thought we perhaps were only reaching some portion of the population. But given the interest that is shown through those expression of interest, we have noticed that people are actually following him. People are actually looking forward to opportunities. Obviously, there are always opposing voices here and there, but that's the nature of human beings. You cannot find human beings in a group, whether it's 5 or 10 or 2 million or 3 million or 50 million, that are all agreeing in one voice. We are different beings. So we're actually impressed to see different ideas, not only from people that are already playing in other industries. We have seen proposals from even some of the scholars that we have funded, because remember, we have sent to school about 183 people that we have sent to schools at university level and as well as the TVET level that we have provided scholarships. We have received proposals from some of those young people, and it was surprising to see that they actually, some of them met the criteria of what we are looking for, and evidence that our investment in terms of education did not really go into vain. As much as they keep waiting for these opportunities to start manifesting fully, it is worth seeing that such an impact has reached almost all the people. Yes, we still have to do a lot of awareness, like what we are doing in Walvis Bay. There are still some people that are hearing in detail of what we are trying to do in the country. So we still have a long way. Remember, this is a new sector. So we still have a long way to make sure that we preach the gospel.
Yeah.
Just like the religious gospel that you don't stop throughout the year, every Sunday people must show up. So it should be the same with us. Every platform we get, we must be able to show up and tell the people and indicate to the people that these are the possible areas where you can plug in and benefit.
Mm, interesting. Yeah. And you're creating awareness even right now.
Yes, and we appreciate such an opportunity coming from you.
Sure. Chana Mshako, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to engage you. Thank you so much for updating us. And of course, it also just goes to say that I guess Namibians, maybe obviously we tend to, overall, not just Namibians, we tend to criticize what we don't understand. That's what I always like to say. But eventually, when awareness and education is made, people tend to come on board and say, oh, okay, now my eyes are open to this. Mm-hmm.
It's a new thing, so we need to keep on talking and then answering questions. We shouldn't really shy away when people are criticizing.
Yeah.
And I tell you, there are certain things that we've improved over the years because of the criticism, because not all the criticism are really meant to damage you or really put you down. It's actually to say, look at this and look at this. It might jeopardize the opportunity. And we've learned a lot from some of those criticisms to really make sure that we perfect what we are doing.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Thank you so much, Chana Mshako.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Of course, there we had it from Jonah Mucheko. Let's now pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. Now, should you be interested in also airing your opinions and contributions right here on the Reading News Analysis? Perhaps you want to get into the conversation as well and talk about your opinion and your contributions towards today's conversation. 083-288-401 is the number in studio. I repeat that again. 083-288-401 is the number in studio. Let's pause right here. We'll be back shortly.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipuramente no wapungwa eva tere urikoni mando tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tite opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuala. Onongeshefa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okupitira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa, mura hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafelane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now let's get into economic indicators before we switch over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Now, $1 today is equals to 16 Namibian dollars, a 0.45 cents. One United Arab Emirates dirham is equals to 4 Namibian dollars, 0.48 cents. £1 sterling is equals to 22 Namibian dollars, 0.22 cents. One Australian dollar is equals to 11 Namibian dollars, 0.77 cents, and €1 is equals to 11 Namibian dollars, 0.32 cents. One Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar, 0.22 cents. And not to forget, one Japanese yen is equals to 0.10 Namibian dollars. Of course, let's cross over now to news beyond the borders of Namibia. As usual, we start off regionally, move over to continental news, and thereafter expect some international news. Again, talking about green industrialization or renewable energy, Graspen Solar Plant has launched in Northern Cape of South Africa. This kind of thing.
Coupled with the blazing Northern Cape sun, coupled with wide open spaces, remain the first option for renewable energy projects. The Graspan solar plant has more than 150,000 solar panels, putting out 180,000 megawatt hours of electricity every year. It created more than 400 jobs and opportunities for local communities.
Because in Tianjuma we have also built 3 other plants already prior to this one, we will also rope in the experience of those SMMEs from Sianuma that will be working here, and also give the opportunity for them to assist in terms of growing and to ensure that going forward we should have SMMEs that is able to do majority of the work of plants that will be coming. As we all know that in this area the sun is nice for extra plants to come, so there can be extra solar plants, there can be investment for winds. Looking at the investment conference outcomes of last week, we know that there is a number of people that will be investing, and we are saying that Sianuma is ready.
But grid capacity issues have been a red flag. Provincial and national governments are negotiating with Eskom to add more capacity.
Grid capacity, has become a big issue in terms of congestion and just not sufficient capacity. But fortunately, with the REAP program, firstly, it's a very well-managed program, a program that has delivered a lot of success. And with that program, they already identify where there is grid capacity access. And both Crossbun and Crossbreak had already pre-allocated grid access. So the challenge to connect to the grid was not there for this one.
South Africa is a great environment. The regulation is strong. When it comes to environment, it's a country which is well organized, that knows industrial projects. So it's a country where investment is easier than in other areas.
The Graspan facility is expected to offset 130,000 tons of CO2 emissions each year. Graspan is expected to be operational for the next 20 years. Ulrich Hendricks, SABC News, Graspan, the Hope Town in the Northern Cape.
SAA records profit, but liquidity challenges do remain.
SAA is turning the corner financially, but it is still not out of trouble due to liquidity challenges. There are concerns that operating costs outweigh the revenue costs, resulting in net operating losses.
So we made an assessment, and when we made an assessment, we found that the SAA is a going concern with material uncertainties. What do we mean when we say that going concern is with material uncertainties? We means that there are certain significant things or conditions or doubts, if they were to happen, the entity might close within the 12 month, which means that it can be insolvent or illiquid. So the challenges that we picked up, one, it was the operating losses that we've mentioned. Two, the negative operating cash flows, which if you look at the cash flow statement, there is a leases that one will say that they are operative in nature, but they are classified under investing income, which those particular leases, they need operating cash flow to be covered.
There are concerns that there are monies that are trapped in foreign land.
SAA is having cash trapped in foreign land, and they are struggling to repatriate those particular funds, namely the countries that are impacted, Zimbabwe, Nigeria, Egypt, and Malawi. And what we have noted is that the cash as reported, and also note that we have modified that cash as part of the reliance on that figure. The amount of 416 million was blocked in foreign land. And in terms of Zimbabwe, to be specific, that amount is recorded as part of the receivables. It was close to 1 billion.
Transport Minister Barbara Creasy maintains that the national carrier is turning the corner.
There was a moderate profit that was declared, but that profit primarily emerges from the sale of the Heathrow slot. And while there was some improvement in passenger numbers and in passenger revenue, I think that we're still a long way from being a profitable entity.
The Auditor General's office has also flagged the lack of consequence management for irregular expenditure, seeing that even theft of over 800,000 rands has not been reported to the police. Ulelani Philip, SABC News, Parliament.
Meanwhile, Rwanda faces a rising cost of living amidst fuel price surge.
Fuel prices in Rwanda are beginning to hit daily life, pushing up transport costs, food prices, and household spending. The increases follow renewed pressure on global oil markets linked to the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. And as Ethan Tashobia reports from Kigali, businesses and commuters are trying to adjust.
At Chiruhura restaurant in Kigali, plates of fish and pilau remain popular with customers during lunch hour. But behind the scenes, rising fuel prices are squeezing the business. Much of the fish comes from Rwanda's western border town of Rubavu on Lake Kivu. The rice is largely imported from Pakistan, Tanzania, and other parts of Asia. But for a landlocked country that depends heavily on goods arriving through Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya, transport costs are quickly affecting the final price on the plate.
Everything we use depends on.
Let's make room for a scheduled commercial break. We'll be back shortly to continue.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Transport, fish, rice, vegetables, and even cooking supplies. When fuel goes up, suppliers increase prices. We try to protect customers, but it is becoming harder.
Fuel prices in Rwanda have risen twice since the war began. In the latest review, premium petrol increased while diesel was kept stable in a move aimed to protecting cargo transport and food supply chains. The government says it is monitoring stocks closely. using market measures to avoid shortages.
We have looked at the stocks that we have. We have looked at the stocks that are on the way coming. And we feel like we should not rush into kind of stringent measures such as rationing or even things like reducing the number of days that people go to work per week. So we have decided to use the market forces to kind of implement the rationing. That includes looking at the number, the frequency with which we review the fuel prices.
The government says it will rely on market adjustments, support fuel imports, and encourage people to use public transport as global uncertainty continues.
We're talking to our partners in the region. We're talking to our oil marketing companies. We are providing some financial support, including providing letters of credit so that they can be allowed to import more products. We are also encouraging our citizens to kind of think of starting to change our behaviors in terms of the way we are used to use personal cars. We want to put emphasis on public transport.
For transport workers, the pressure is immediate. Some motorcycle taxi drivers say profits are shrinking, while passengers struggle with higher fares. Others are now switching to electric bikes, which are cheaper to run.
The conflict in Iran has had a big impact on us. Before, a trip that cost 1,000 francs a few months ago is now double that price because fuel prices have gone up. Passengers complain, yet we also have to survive. This is a difficult period for fuel bikes, but an opportunity for electric motorcycles.
With global uncertainty still high, many here hope prices will soon be going back down.
The impact of rising fuel prices is being felt far beyond the pump. From restaurants to transport operators and households, many are now rethinking how they spend, travel and do business. For Rwanda, the challenge is managing today's pressure while accelerating the shift towards cheaper and cleaner energy options. Ethan Tashubia for CGTN, Kigali, Rwanda.
Meanwhile, France values South African ties despite the G7 exclusion.
The question of the de-invitation of South Africa from the G20 has been evoked several times between Sherpas and diplomatic advisors at sort of diplomatic level behind closed doors. And we absolutely do consider that France being also a founding member of the G20, we consider, of course, that South Africa is a full-fledged member of the G20 and should be part of all of its meetings. As for the G7, I can only refer to what President Ramaphosa said about it, if I remember, it's something like, you can't be de-invited from a forum you don't belong to.
France's ambassador to South Africa says Paris will always value its strategic partnership with Pretoria. On wider global tensions, Ambassador David Matinon says the crisis in the Middle East has severely disrupted world trade, adding that the Strait of Hormuz must remain open.
Starting point is the consideration that the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz has a huge impact, and notably a huge impact on Africa, because it means that Africa doesn't get the fertilizers it needs for its agriculture, that the cost of fuel and gas in Africa is going to the roof. If you see the price of gas in Malawi, for example, it's the highest price in the world right now. So President Macron and Prime Minister Keir Starmer from the UK took together the initiative of convening a meeting on April 17th with not less than 50 non-belligerent states to affirm a few things. One, reopening the Strait of Hormuz and freeing navigation in these waters because they are absolutely critical.
The diplomats stressed the significance of the France-Africa summit, where key continental and global challenges will be on the agenda.
It's an extremely important gathering because, one, it's part of the program of the French G7 presidency. And really the intention is to taking stock of what the South African presidency has been doing during the G20, and notably on such critical topics as the cost of capital for developing countries, the just energy transition, those kind of topics.
Peace and security will also feature high on the agenda in Nairobi.
There are pockets of crisis on the continent that are affecting whole regions like the Horn of Africa. You know, the crisis in Sudan, which is the biggest humanitarian tragedy really globally today, it is affecting South Sudan, Ethiopia, Chad, on the borders of the of Sudan. You know, there's fighting, there's displacement.
Analysts say France recognizes the rapidly shifting geopolitical landscape and is moving to strengthen trade ties with a wider range of partners.
France definitely understands that it has to diversify its engagements, not only in Africa, but I would argue even in the global south. If you look at even some of the countries that they are inviting to this France-Africa meeting in Nairobi, they're inviting the likes of Brazil, the likes of India. So I think they understand that there is a fundamental change that is taking place in the transatlantic partnership between Europe and the US.
France adds that its investment footprint in South Africa is expanded sharply across multiple sectors, including energy and infrastructure. Meanwhile, the presidency has confirmed that President Cyril Ramaphosa will not attend the France-Africa summit in Nairobi due to prior commitments. Kailihle Khumalo, SABC News, Johannesburg.
Meanwhile, Nigeria partners with China in order to boost egg production.
Nigeria is turning to China in a major push to scale up egg production and bring down rising food prices. The government says it plans, with Chinese support, to build 6 large industrial poultry farms, each producing 1 million eggs a day. Officials say the project could ease supply shortages and eventually support export. CGTN's Tese Makende reports.
21-year-old Timothy Haruna works at this poultry farm in Jos. He says the plant partnership with China could help tackle some of the industry's biggest challenges.
It's a good idea. We working with China in poultry, because we in poultry, we are facing so many challenges. So with their help, we can grow up and reach a starting stage that we should be proud of ourselves. The production of egg will increase and the prices will come down. People are also complaining about our eggs that is very high.
Nigeria, with an estimated annual egg production of 650 million tons, is the largest egg producer in Africa, followed by South Africa and Egypt. But output has struggled to keep pace with demand. Prices have been climbing in recent months. A crate now sells for about $4 at the farm, up from just about $3 in January. Farmers say a shortage of day-old chicks is a key factor. Many have sold off older birds but can't easily replace them. The Poultry Association says hatcheries are exporting more chicks to markets like Dubai and Cameroon, where returns are higher. This has pushed local chick prices sharply higher, from about 39 cents in 2024 to roughly $1.38 now. Officials say the new Nigeria-China partnership aims to address these gaps. Each of the 6 plant farms will be fully integrated to improve efficiency and output. All farms are to possess 10,000 hectares of land for cultivation of soybeans and maize, which will serve as a feedstock for the chickens. They are also to have a hatchery, power-generating plants, and feed mill for efficiency. Agriculture experts agree the plan could improve egg supply and availability, but some warn that smaller farmers may struggle to compete with large-scale foreign-backed operations. Instead, they are urging the government to also support local producers with financing and modern facilities.
Because it actually means that they will be sending a lot of smallholder farmers out of the market, because they will be competing alongside these people that are producing a huge amount of eggs. We will actually have local farmers that can actually bring up, that can actually meet up the production line, if only they have a lot of facilities that are given to them. So it should be a win-win thing for both sides, where you have the farmers still existing.
The government has yet to respond to calls for wider consultation, but maintains that modernizing the sector is essential to boosting production. For now, with the project yet to begin, egg prices remain under pressure. Tasim Akindi, CGTN Jos, Nigeria.
Meanwhile, the European Union has resumed budget support towards Ethiopia.
The European Union has announced a new wave of investment alongside the resumption of budget support to Ethiopia. It comes as policymakers and business leaders gather in Addis Ababa for a high-level forum regarding Africa's continental free trade ambitions. Despite getting off to a slow start, experts say the African continental free trade area is slowly reshaping trade flows and investment opportunities across the continent.
Held in Addis Ababa, the EU-Ethiopia Business Forum has brought together policymakers, investors and private sector leaders to explore opportunities in one of Africa's fastest growing economies. Organized under the EU's Global Gateway Strategy, the forum focuses on clean energy, digital transformation, healthcare, and sustainable agriculture, which are sectors widely viewed as essential to Ethiopia's long-term goal of growth, industrialization, and economic diversification.
The European Union investment flows onto the African continent exceed €250 billion, accounting for roughly 40 to 50% of total FDI flows into the African continent. This position is now further strengthened by the existence of the AfCFTA, which liberalizes the investment market, liberalizes the trade regime, and enables European companies to take full advantage of economies of scale and to ensure that they see returns on their investment.
The African Continental Free Trade Area, now the world's largest by number of participating countries, is advancing efforts to create a unified African market to boost intra-Africa trade and attract global investment. Against this backdrop, the African Union and the AfCFTA implementation partners have reinforced cooperation through a memorandum of understanding aimed at accelerating integration and reducing trade barriers. The European Union has responded with a new investment package focused on infrastructure, digital connectivity, and inclusive growth closely aligned with Ethiopia's reform agenda and regional integration goals. A key component is a digital economy initiative designed to strengthen connectivity, governance, and skills development, positioning Ethiopia to integrate more effectively into regional and global value chains.
We announced a package of investments focused on three areas that matter most to people in their everyday lives. This is reliable energy and connectivity, jobs and agriculture, and healthcare. We signed the digital economy package, a joint framework with the Ethiopian government on digital infrastructure, skills and governance, with €150 million already committed, and the ambition is double that.
Additional financing agreements signed during the forum also target agriculture and rural development sectors that remain central to Ethiopia's economy. In a significant policy shift, the European Union also announced the resumption of budget support to Ethiopia, marking a renewed phase of engagement following recent reforms.
But the most significant announcement of the day is the resumption of EU budget support to Ethiopia. As you know, this support was suspended in 2020 following the conflict in northern Ethiopia. We are resuming it now as a clear signal of our confidence in the reforms this government is pursuing and our commitment to this partnership for the long term. This unlocks a substantial package of over 140 million euro to support our shared priorities: energy, connectivity, health, and improving the business environment.
Officials say the renewed support will strengthen energy access, expand a digital infrastructure, improve healthcare delivery, and enhance the overall business environment, which are key pillars for attracting sustained investment under the AFCFTA framework. Beryl Oro, CGTN.
Meanwhile, Uganda considers tighter controls on cross-border farm gate trade.
Cross-border trade is a daily reality across East Africa. It quietly moves food from farm to market across the region. But in Uganda, recent concerns about farm gate sales have sparked a closer look at how this system actually works. CGTN's Michael Baleke reports.
On the outskirts of Kampala, farmers harvest produce right at the farm. Most buyers are local traders, not foreigners, who organize transport and link farmers to markets across the region. From here, the produce is sorted, packed, and prepared for transport to different markets. Ali Cheyune has been farming for 10 years and prefers to sell on the farm.
Taking produce to the market involves many costs, but when traders come here, I don't have to worry about transport, fuel, or bad roads. I'm paid right here. And when I sell everything at once, like these sweet potatoes, it helps me prepare the garden quickly for the next season.
Out here, the first step in the trade happens at harvest, as farmers bring in crops and prepare them for buyers.
Standing here in the garden, you can see how it all begins. Farmers harvesting crops like these sweet potatoes, with buyers coming in at different stages of the day. From here, the produce starts its journey beyond the farm.
That movement keeps supply chains going. Produce comes in and out depending on demand. For many, it's a system built on timing, access to transport, and regional markets.
I prefer buying from the garden because I can choose the quality that the market needs. The produce is fresh, so it lasts longer on the shelves. It also gives me room to agree on a better price, which helps when I take it to the market.
But the system has raised concerns among policymakers. They are calling for tighter controls. They say some buyers bypass formal markets, which can affect pricing and quality standards.
That really curtails compliance to the requisite standards, but also meeting the quality requirements. Because sometimes when produce is bought from the gardens, then the control of the garden moves from the farmer to the person who has bought, the middleman or the trader. And so the middlemen, we should also appreciate that they are driven by profit motives. All they want are profits.
At the same time, officials at the Ministry of Finance say restricting such trade is not straightforward. Uganda is part of the East African Community, where cross-border trade is protected under regional agreements.
This is ESC. There is a free, it's a common market, but also Ugandans have the freedom to sell to whoever they want and at what price. It's you to negotiate there. Government can't come and say, sell this one at this price.
For farmers and traders, the focus remains on access to buyers, transport, and markets beyond borders. As governments weigh their options, the challenge is to improve the system without disrupting a trade network that many depend on. Michael Baleke, CGTN, Kampala.
In other words, at least two ships have been attacked in the Strait of Hormuz. amid U.S.-Iran ceasefire extension.
Look at the radar system there at the Strait of Hormuz, courtesy of marine traffic. The Associated Press just coming down with this, that Iran's semi-official news agencies are now reporting that the paramilitary Revolutionary Guard has attacked a third ship in the Strait of Hormuz, throwing into question efforts to end the war. Those news outlets all reported the attack by the Guard on a vessel called the Euphoria. They said the vessel had become, quote, stranded on the Iranian coast without elaborating. The Guard has seized the other two ships that were attacked, according to Iranian state television, who separately reported.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump says he will extend Iran's ceasefire until negotiations conclude.
Hours before a two-week ceasefire between the United States and Iran was due to expire, and shortly after signaling that American forces were prepared to resume strikes, President Trump announced an extension to the truce. In a post on social media, the president said the ceasefire would remain in place until Iran's leadership presents a unified proposal to end the conflict. He added that the U.S. blockade of Iranian ports would continue until negotiations are concluded. The status of the U.S.-Iran talks remains unclear. The White House has confirmed that Vice President J.D. Vance's planned trip to Pakistan for peace negotiations is cancelled for now. He had been expected to travel to Islamabad for the second time this month in an effort to help finalise an agreement with Iranian officials. For the latest, let's talk to our North America correspondent, David Willis. So, David, the ceasefire is extended, but when it comes to talks, it's very unclear what might happen next.
Very much so, Sally. President Trump saying in that Truth Social social media post that he is extending the ceasefire agreement, an open-ended extension in response to Pakistani mediators' pleas, but he is not lifting the U.S. blockade on ships seeking to enter or leave Iranian ports. And that has been a move that has incensed the Iranians. They have even been suggestions that it could prompt some sort of military response in and of itself. It's been likened by itself to an act of war as well as a breach of the ceasefire agreement. As for the extension of the ceasefire, well, the Iranians have also dismissed that, calling it meaningless. So where are we now? Well, there is certainly time for both sides to figure out what they might be able to talk about when, if they go back to the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. But there is so much mistrust between the two sides. Even the suggestion on Iran's part that this all could be a ruse on the part of the Trump administration of the United States to buy the U.S. some time in order for it to mount another surprise attack on Iran.
David, thank you so much. David Willis there. Thank you so much for the latest details on that. Well, Iran's most senior leaders have yet to comment on the ceasefire extension. The Tasnim news agency, which is affiliated with the country's Revolutionary Guard, says Tehran did not request an extension and has reiterated threats to break the U.S. blockade by force. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is reporting from Tehran. On condition none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service, these restrictions apply to all international media organizations operating in Iran. And she gave us the government's reaction to the prospect of further talks with the U.S.
Well, I don't think they have much faith in this process. We were at the foreign ministry this afternoon and we're told the foreign minister was locked in meetings. They were still exchanging messages through mediators, but they still hadn't decided whether to return to talks with the United States. And we sat down with the foreign ministry spokesperson, Ismail Baghai. He had been at the last round of face-to-face talks in Islamabad. He listed all the reasons: President Trump's threats to bomb Iran, its naval blockade in the Strait of Hormuz, the sea of an Iranian vessel, all of which, he said, were ceasefire violations. So I put it to him that Iran was also violating the truce. Under the terms of the ceasefire, you said you would completely pull back from the Strait of Hormuz. You haven't.
You remember the first days?
Ceasefire in Lebanon was part of the ceasefire package.
So that's agreed now. What about the Strait of Hormuz?
That's agreed. We agreed on last Friday. And you remember what happened after our foreign minister tweeted that Iran would reopen the Strait of Hormuz in accordance with the terms of the ceasefire. What was President Trump's reaction? He immediately said, thank you, Iran. And then minutes later or an hour later, he said that, but we would keep our blockade.
Another big reason, of course, is the huge distrust in this process. Remember that the two previous rounds of talks with the U.S. last year in June, this year in February, were shattered by U.S.-backed Israeli airstrikes. So while Iran would welcome this extension of the ceasefire, they feel there is a real risk of a return to war. And pretty well every Iranian we speak to here believes that too.
Lise Doucette, who is in Tehran for us. Well, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Shehbaz Sharif, has been reacting to the ceasefire extension in a post on X. The Prime Minister said he sincerely thanked President Trump for accepting the request to extend the ceasefire to allow diplomatic efforts to take their course, adding that Pakistan would continue efforts for a negotiated settlement of the conflict. The Prime Minister also stated his hopes that both sides would continue to observe this ceasefire and the second round of talks scheduled in Islamabad would result in a permanent end to the conflict. Well, let's go live.
Meanwhile, phone tracking shows how Colombian mercenaries backed as Sudan's RSF report says.
A new report says that Colombian mercenaries backed by the United Arab Emirates helped Sudanese paramilitary fighters capture the city of El Fasher last year. The Conflict Insights Group claims that this is the first research that proves UAE connections to the rapid support forces with certainty in Sudan. Well, we can cross over now to our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher, who is in Nairobi. Barbara, very good to have you with us. Just tell us more about this report from the Conflict Insights Group and how it was able to carry out this research and track this.
Sure, Helena. So the Conflict Insights Group is a data analysis entity that researches conflict. And what it did was it tracked the mobile phones of more than 50 Colombian mercenaries in Sudan. It used commercially available technology that is designed to personalize advertising. Now, it has been widely reported for some time that Colombian mercenaries are helping the paramilitary rapid support forces in the civil war. But what this report says is that it was able, using these phones, to track some of the mercenaries to the city of El Fasher during a period last October when the rapid support forces took over El Fasher, and that was documented to have committed many atrocities, something that the International Criminal Court called war crimes. So the report says that the Colombian mercenaries' support through technical assistance with drones and with artillery contributed to the scale of the atrocities. The second thing that this report does is it makes these connections to the United Arab Emirates. Now, Helena, again, it's been widely reported for a long time that the UAE provides military support to the rapid support forces, but it has repeatedly and emphatically denied that that is the case. What this report says is that it tracked some of those mobile phones from Colombia to a military training site in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, also to a staging post in northern Somalia and Puntland, where the UAE has a military presence. And then those phones ended up in RSF-held territory in Sudan. One of those phones, it says, logged into a Wi-Fi network called Desert Wolves. Now, that is known to be the name of the Colombian mercenary brigade. These mercenaries are recruited by a Colombian company which has been sanctioned by the U.S., but it is operated by a private company in the United Arab Emirates with very close ties to the state. Now, that company denies this, but it has been the result of there have been three different groups that have investigated this and say it is the case.
And Barbara, you mentioned some of the atrocities of El Fasher. Just remind us more of what happened there and how significant it is, because its fall, the fall of El Fasher, was one of the most brutal chapters of this conflict. Ultimately, it led to what we are talking about now, the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Well, it certainly contributed to it, although other things have as well. But Al-Fashir was one of, was a city in western, is a city in western Sudan in the area of Darfur, which is an RSF stronghold. And the RSF had it under siege for 18 months. So people left if they could, but otherwise came close to starvation in many cases. And then at the end, the RSF took over in October, and there was widely documented accounts of mass killings, of detentions, of rapes, and so on. Again, there's been an investigation by the UN, which they said, in which they said the things that happened there bore the hallmarks of genocide. Now, this report put out by the CIG says that the the Colombian mercenaries there were providing critical help in terms of drone operation. That's one of the things they do. Also, in terms of helping with artillery fire, and it says clearly that the Colombian mercenaries and the UAE, because it claims that the UAE backs them, do share some responsibility for this. Now, it should be said, Helena, that foreign backing of the two parties is wider than just the UAE and the RSF. The Sudanese armed forces get weapons or have been believed to be getting drones from Iran as well as from Turkey. And the foreign backing for both sides, analysts agree, has contributed to the continuation and the escalation of this conflict.
All right. Barbara Platt-Usher there. Many thanks indeed.
With that being said, we now pause here and hand over the mic to my colleague Loise Shimi, and she brings you the Onkon and Adenge program. Also, do stay tuned for the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut, and then the Business Economic segment with David Shombe. From Indafa, happy Juju. It is goodbye.